Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the stunning Chauvet cave paintings to the legend of the Trojan War to Black Beauty, horses have captured the human imagination across millennia. But as humans, it moved from simply observing and sketching wild horses to domesticating them for work and for sport. We lost a fundamental understanding of their behavior. Or so argues Wendy Williams in her new book, The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companions. Wendy's going to be reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Thursday at 7. But first, I'm so pleased to welcome her back to Word of Mouth. Hello, Wendy.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and really excited about this book. I mean, I, like many people, have considered myself a horsey person for a long time, but learned so much here. It's kind of a big epic history. So let's
Well, you know, I have to tell you that although I've lived my whole life with horses, I'm 65 now, and I learned all kinds of things writing this book, so I'm not surprised.
Well, let's dive into this. I mean, can that love of horses be explained biologically? Are human beings kind of hardwired to love horses?
In a sense, I think you're right. I think we are. I think there's just something magical about the S-curve that goes from the ears all the way down to the tail that is attractive to us on a really basic mathematical level. And I think we also relate to them really well because they are very social animals like us. Just the way that humans live in family groups, horses, it turns out, also live in very small groups called bands. And the basis of these bands are sometimes family ties, and sometimes it's just the mares like to have a lot of girlfriends around that they enjoy being with.
How are these small groups formed?
You know, they're formed in a number of ways. Sometimes it has to do with a family relationship, but sometimes it just has to do with the mares grew up with other mares and never parted ways. Sometimes a mare might come from some other band and decide that she likes the mares in this particular band and stick around. One of the things that I thought was really interesting in the research that I did was to find out that the stallion has a lot less central role in the safety and well-being of the band than we previously thought. The stallion is important, and there is almost always a stallion with a band of mares, but he doesn't run the show the way we used to think.
Well, there are stories that you tell of the distinction between mares and stallions, one of a free-roaming mare in Wyoming. But first, tell us, what is free-roaming, not wild?
You know, I use the words free roaming and free ranging a lot. Sometimes I use the word wild. I don't use the word feral. The word wild has certain connotations for people, and I think sometimes those connotations can confuse the discussion. There really isn't, genetically speaking, that much difference between horses that are out on the American plains running on their own and the horses that we have in the barn.
So genetically, they may be identical, but you have seen some differences in behavior between the free-ranging and domesticated horses in a couple of different scenarios, including witnessing mustangs in New Hampshire. Now, first of all, there are mustangs in New Hampshire? I had no idea.
Yes, I was very surprised to find that out myself. And what the Coco family does is rehabilitate mustangs who have been adopted by people and who have not been able to really take care of the Mustangs very well for one reason or another. They haven't had the right facilities and they haven't had enough knowledge. And the Coco Farm has a great deal of expertise in knowing how to care for these horses. One of the very interesting things that they do is let them roam out in their fields all year round. They don't bring them in the wintertime. They don't blanket them. They don't brush them. They let them do their Mustang thing. Even last winter in all that incredible snow, the horses were out on their own, and they did fine. Stephanie Coco, the matriarch of the household there, told me that what they do when it's cold, they just walk. She said they get together in groups, and they just walk and walk and pace. If I had to pick one difference between horses kept in a barn and horses allowed to roam freely, I would say that the free-roaming horses tend to be extremely curious animals.
And it also, I thought it was kind of interesting that there's a sort of age range inside of these bands often.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what you might see is the older mares who are wiser, more experienced, and more stable might form the sort of core of the group, kind of like in real life. And the foals are born and stay with that band for a short amount of time and then disappear to go off to find their fortune elsewhere. And you might find that they might come back after a while, just as we do, or they might not. They might have found a permanent bond somewhere else where they decide to stay. So it really depends on the individual animal. Some, just as in real life, just as with human beings, some people want to stay home where they were born, and some people want to roam the world. Horses are the same way.
Is there a hierarchy within these groups?
I think not. What science is telling us is that within a core group of mares, you may find not so much of a hierarchy as a give and take. That some mares may very strongly want such and such thing. They may decide they want to go for a drink of water, and the other mares will follow along. Then a whole separate mare will decide that she wants to go somewhere with better grass, and those mares will follow along. So it really, really depends on what's going on at the moment as to who makes the decision.
Wendy Williams is with us. She previously joined us on Word of Mouth to talk about the kraken, the cephalopods, and our human fascination with them. Well, now she's talking with us about the horse. She's written an epic history of our noble companions. I wonder what that means for group safety. You know, in a group of antelopes, you travel all together and the decisions are made together because there are probably, possibly tigers, you know, or lions out there ready to get you. How about with groups of horses?
I think when it comes to issues of safety that they're probably very much in unison as far as what they can and can't do. I suspect that if an enemy came, a mountain lion in the American West, for example, that the horses might very quickly become unified into one group. Some say that that's where the stallion does come in handy because the stallion may turn and fight the invader mountain lion and the other mares may watch, and some mares may actually help. Some ethologists, some people who study horse behavior in the wild, have seen mares actually pitch in and help to fight off dangerous predators.
All right, so this is bringing me so full circle back around to the story of Hightail the mare, a free-roaming mare in Wyoming. Please just tell us a little bit about her.
Oh, I love the story of Hightail. It just warmed my heart. I think one of the reasons that I liked Hightail so much is that when we saw her, the ethologist who took me to see her had data from at least 10 years. So the scientists know a lot about who she is or who she has been, her backstory, as I say in the book. When we saw her, she was a pretty aged mare and didn't look so great. She needed to put on a little bit more weight. She could have done with a shampooing and someone to fluff up her mane and tail. She looked pretty worn out, and she was eating just food that I would never have thought that a horse would eat. Just absolutely the dregs of the dregs. But her backstory was really very dramatic and quite romantic. She grew up and made a first attachment with a stallion, and she left the band to be with this stallion, and they roamed the world for a while. Then another stallion came by and stole Hightail from stallion number one, and Hightail didn't really want to be with stallion number two, so she kept running off, and stallion number two kept attacking her and forcing her to come back with him. But eventually he gave up, and as soon as his back was turned, she took off and went back with stallion number one, because that's the stallion that she wanted to be with. Her life had many vagaries after that. She ended up in a lot of other places and was companioned with stallion number three for a while. But eventually that stallion, as I say in the book, fell from grace. No one really knew what happened with him. So the next time the scientists saw her, she was back with stallion number one. Mm. And she stayed with stallion number one until he died.
Well, it implies a sort of willfulness, or one of the observers called it subtle deceit.
There was some subtle deceit, yes. There was some subtle deceit.
What would be an example of that?
Well, the story that I love most in that, as you know from reading the book, the Jason Ransom, the ethologist I worked with, and I went over to Spain, to the northwestern corner of Spain, to a place called Galicia, where there are free-roaming horses that have a deep history. Maybe they are the original free-roaming horses from which a great deal of our modern horses come. We don't know for sure. But they're still there in the mountains of Galicia, living their lives, fighting off the wolves. And Lara Lagos is a young ethologist who is working with a senior ethologist, Felipe Barcena.
And what do ethologists do, if you could remind me?
Yes, yes. An ethologist is a scientist who studies the natural behavior of animals in the wild. And Lara had watched two particular mares who were very good companions. They were part of a band, but they were they had special bonds within that band. And when it came time to mate, the two mares went off on their own together to visit with a stallion of another band. And one mare mated, and then the two mares came back to their original band, and it was time for the second mare to mate. They left again. They went off to the other stallion of the other band. She mated, and then they came back. So Lara was quite astonished by this behavior and watched what they did the next year at the same time, and she saw exactly the same behavior. So this kind of intense bonding, it really can't be explained by anything that we previously knew about horses, but we know it can persist over quite a long time.
So they're willing partners. I guess it's easy to project when hearing these stories, personality onto a horse. I don't know if that's too anthropomorphic, but how complex are these emotions and personalities of horses? As an equestrian, have you experienced that for yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my regrets was not having had the information that I have now. I didn't really understand in depth what I was seeing. But absolutely, horses have very, very complex personalities, at least as complex as dogs or as complex as us. Like dogs and like humans, horses live in small groups where personal bonds are really, really important for their survival.
I was thinking also of a horse that you had, Whisper.
Oh. Whisper.
Yeah, what can you tell us about Whisper?
Well, Whisper was the result of my lifelong yearning for a horse. When I got out of college, I could finally act on that, and Whisper came into my care after I had graduated from school, and I rented a house with a barn. But I'm living in Vermont, and it's January. It's minus 10 degrees as a matter of routine in the night where I was living. And I got up one morning and I had my coffee and I thought, well, I think I just need another cup of coffee before I go out and tackle the barn. So I poured myself another cup of coffee very indulgently and looked out my kitchen window and I saw Whisper come sailing over the fence and come right up to the water spigot, which was on the side of the house in front of the kitchen window. And Whisper took a hoof, and he went bang, 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 and on went the water. I'm very lucky that the water actually went on, because if it hadn't, he could very well have broken the spigot. The reason he knew about that was because I had thought earlier in the year when it was warmer that I was being very clever in bringing the horses up to the water spigot instead of running the water down. I had to carry it down in buckets. Instead of carrying it down in buckets, I had brought the horses up to drink their fill. So he knew where the water came from, and when he was thirsty, he decided to get it for himself.
Such a sweet story. You know, right now, horses are no longer needed so much for labor or for transport in most parts of the world. So what does that mean for our relationship with horses? Will we see more, you know, wild roaming horses? Can they ever be truly wild in our mind again?
I think they are plenty wild now when they're allowed to be out on their own. I really think there's no difference between the domestic horses we have in stables and the wild horses roaming out in the various areas all over the world, really, that manage on their own. You'll find some visual differences. They, if left on their own devices, they aren't quite as big as the ones we've bred to be big, or they're not as glowing. They may not have special gaits that make people feel that they're extremely elegant, but really beauty's only skin deep. The essential horse is the essential horse, and it's there whether we're dealing with them in the barn or whether we're dealing with them out on the range.
Wendy Williams, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been lots of fun. Thanks for asking me.
Wendy Williams is a journalist and equestrian and author of The Horse, an epic history of our noble companions. You can see her in person reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord this Thursday evening. There are details at wordofmouthradio.org.